By the time a typical New York City public school student graduates from high school, he or she will have taken at least 20 state-mandated standardized tests. That doesn't include the specialized entrance exams for everything from kindergarten to high school, nor the SAT, the ACT, and the AP, that acronym-heavy barrage of tests used to determine college readiness. Just when did we get so obsessed with testing, and what in the end do these tests really tell us? On today's Please Explain, we'll look into the history and design of tests. We'll find out how they're designed, why we have to take so many, and what the results can and can't tell us about performance. I'm very pleased that it brings to this Please Explain segment City University Professor of Psychology and Senior Research Fellow Howard Everson and Professor of Educational Psychology David Rinskoff, who's also at CUNY. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Howard, is there one satisfying definition for what a test is?
Well, typically we think of tests as collections of tasks or test items that, when taken together and looked at as a collection, we can score and use to make judgments or inferences about students' academic ability.
Do we have any sense of when standardized testing was first introduced? Was it in China?
Well, we have some history that there was forms of standardized testing used in China many, many, many years ago, hundreds of years ago, largely for selecting applicants for the civil service and government service in China.
Weren't Western educational institutions hesitant to use standardized tests because they preferred to focus more on the Greek tradition of essays and Socratic dialogue?
That's right. That's right.
And so when did that change?
And we inherited that tradition here in the United States with the early testing at the College Board, for example, the early College Board tests, which were used largely by the Ivy League institutions in the early part of the 20th century.
David, when was the first standardized test developed in the United States?
Well, the College Board that Howard mentioned fits some definitions of what a standardized test is. Not that it was multiple choice, it was essays, but it had standard questions, standard sets of items, and graded in relatively standard ways using rubrics.
And why was it developed? For a long time, didn't every college just give you its own test?
Yes, and as things went along, what you needed was a way to compare people, first of all, who went to different kinds of schools and who might be applying to a number of different schools, and you didn't want to have, say, 10 different tests to have to go through to get into 10 different institutions.
But didn't it also have its origins in World War I and the Army Alpha and Beta tests that were developed by Robert Yerkes and his colleagues?
That's one of the early uses of standardized testing, and I think a product of that was what later developed into the Educational Testing Service and College Board tests.
And what were those early types of standardized tests like?
Well, you did have tests that measured some sort of not some were subject matter, but a lot of them were things of general reasoning and specialized knowledge. And you did have multiple choice tests. That was one of the origins of multiple choice tests. They didn't have computers to score them back then, but
they were graded by hand.
By hand, but there were easy ways to do that if you had some sort of a template that you could put over a sheet to count up the answers. It was possible to do it somewhat expeditiously.
But I'm getting the sense that you're saying that the early tests were more like IQ tests and less like tests of knowledge. Howard?
That's clearly the case. That's the genesis and the history of standardized testing in the United States. It was in many ways imported from the work that Alfred Binet was doing in Paris at the end of the 19th century, and James McKean Cattell and Yerkes and others adopted those methods and technologies and used them in a large-scale way for the first time at the beginning of World War I.
Wasn't there another side to the standardized tests? Weren't they first used for diagnostic purposes to see where instruction was strong and where it was weak? More about the teachers than their students?
I think that was an original idea, an initial idea, but they very rapidly became quite useful and still are today for selection and placement. So selecting people for jobs and placing people in schools or in particular employment settings.
And in diagnosing what problems they might have and what you might do about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now they're also used as ways of measuring what schools are succeeding and failing and in New York City, whether we should close a school or not. So at a certain point, these tests became part of the political process, didn't they?
Well, it became political, but it was supposedly for an educational purpose. The question is it serving that purpose, and is it serving that purpose well?
What role, Howard, did these standardized tests what role did the law that mandated testing have in the fact that standardized tests have become so ubiquitous, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965.
Right. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act in 65 began a move in testing to use standardized tests for accountability purposes, for judging educational quality and accountability. And
what was happening in 1965 that led to that?
Well, we began to become much more concerned about the quality of schooling in the United States and our international competitiveness. Some of that came from a little bit earlier era with Sputnik and the move to improve math and science education in the United States, which is still a formidable movement today.
We're talking about tests on today's Please Explain with Howard Everson and David Rinskoff, both of CUNY. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How has the concept and use of standardized testing changed since the enactment of No Child Left Behind?
Well, it's become much more ubiquitous. Nearly every state in the union, I think it's 48 or 49 states right now, use large-scale standardized tests in grades 3 through 8 for accountability purposes. So there's been an enormous increase in the use of the development and use of standardized tests.
But there's been a lot of dissatisfaction with No Child Left Behind. Do you think we'll ever go back, that is, give fewer standardized tests in schools?
There's a move now currently funded by the Obama administration to begin to think about the design and redesign of the next generation of tests. Depending upon how those designs unfold, we may see less testing in the sense that we may not be testing every grade level, every child at every grade level. So some of the ways in which we test are likely to change. That may result in somewhat less testing, but also I think more powerful tests.
And in addition, depending on what your purpose is, you don't need to test every child on everything completely in detail. If what you want to know is how well a school is doing, for example, you could have 200 items on math and you give 10 of them to one child, another 10 to another child, and so on. And there are designs that can then aggregate this. So you don't have to have each child doing a very, very long test. I don't think people have made enough use of some of the designs that are available to get information that they need.
We're going to be talking to listeners later. Our number here is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. David, can you walk us through the basic standardized test from creation to implementation? What are some of the biggest factors to consider when someone is designing a test?
Well, let's divide it into two kinds of tests, although they're probably more. Suppose I want to know how much knowledge a child has in some subject they've been taught, then I have to go from a plan of the instruction and see what they've been taught, and I have to develop a test based on that instructional plan. But if I have a test that's supposed to be predictive, let's say an entrance exam to medical school, I don't do an entrance exam to medical school by having items like, let's see how well you do surgery now, and if you do surgery well now, we'll let you into medical school and you'll learn more about doing surgery. So a predictive test, a placement test like that, would be based on things that I think might be related to what they're going to be doing later. So it's two different kinds of test development depending on the purpose.
But you still have to decide on setting certain standards before you create the test.
Well, the standards, meaning how well they do, that comes later. because after we've developed the items that we think are relevant, we have to try them out. And in the case of predicting later performance, I have to wait until people have gone through whatever later training they've done, see how well they do in that or in their careers, and then see if my test has predicted that.
When people think about standardized tests these days, they usually think about multiple choice exams. Is that where they've gone? I know when I was in school, they used to mix an awful lot of essays in with the multiple choices.
The move has been in the past 20 years or so, maybe even a little bit longer than that, to use multiple choice items, largely because they're efficient, they're easy to score, they're not so easy to write and create, but there are methods now for creating them and using them. So you can test a broad range of abilities or a broad range of a curriculum, for example, in a relatively short time using multiple choice tests. And time is important, especially when you're you're trading off instructional time for testing time in a school system.
David, aren't there two basic types of standardized tests, norm-referenced and criterion-referenced? What's the difference?
Yeah, a norm-referenced test, you're being compared to other people. How well do you do to compare to someone else? And in a criterion-referenced test, it's compared your performance to some standard. So, for example, when you take a driver's license test, we don't see whether you're a better driver than someone else. We just see whether you can beat the standard, whatever that minimum standard is, and that's a criterion reference test. If, on the other hand, we're interested in who's best in something, or then we're comparing people to other people, and that's a norm reference test.
Well, which test type is better for, let's say, testing eighth grade math or for college readiness?
Well, let's say eighth grade math, you probably have two different views depending on what your purpose is in doing the test. If you want to see who's mastered the material, then you're thinking of it as criterion referenced. You know, how many of my students have learned the material well enough to satisfy me? On the other hand, if you're doing an eighth grade math test to compare, everybody's interested in comparisons of countries. So you hear, and that's one of the topics I'm sure you'll get to, is international comparisons. Everybody wants to see who's the best. But nobody's looking to see, well, what do they actually know?
Are there other types of tests other than these two approaches?
There are diagnostic tests that are now being developed, standards reference tests, which are a slight variation on criterion reference tests, where the standards are imposed in some consensus or political process of agreeing on how good is good or how. But the basic framework and blueprint for the tests are largely similar.
A caller wants to know about racial biases in tests, in particular the recent Supreme Court decision about norm reference tests that have a built-in failure rate. Maybe I got the question wrong.
Yeah, we're kind of mixing
the
up
the New Haven issues. Firefighters
case. Right. So we're always concerned. We're always concerned about what we call disparate impact or an adverse impact from using a selection device or a test for purposes of selection. And there is a great deal of work done on existing tests and tests when they're being developed and planned for use to ensure that those adverse impacts are not directly related to the instrument itself. That is, they could be a result of prior learning or prior experiences. Obviously, there are individual differences in those regards. But what we take great pain to do is to ensure that the instrumentation itself is not the cause of the disparate performance.
Before we go to some calls, and again, our number here is 646-829-3985. We also welcome your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Howard, didn't you work on designing the SAT at some point?
I did.
Can we talk about the SATs? Because that's the standardized test is probably the best known.
Right.
When was it first administered?
Well, in its current version, multiple choice with math section and verbal section and now a writing section. That form of the test was first administered in the early 1940s and then became much more widely used and around the nation after World War II with the advent of the GI Bill and returning veterans to colleges and universities. So it has its it has its roots directly back, I guess, to say, I would say around 1941. Now, the College Board had a scholastic examination system in place before that, but it was of a different kind. It was more essay tests, and it tested a broad range of what was then considered the available secondary school curriculum.
The SATs underwent significant changes in 2005. Right. Why were those changes made?
They were the result of educational change and pressure from the educational community trying to make the argument was made that tests like the SAT ought to reflect more closely what was taught in high schools so that students would have a fairer opportunity and a fairer chance of doing well on the tests.
We have posted some SAT questions on our website. There are four from 1934, two from 1943, and several from the most recent SAT tests. And listeners who are interested in looking at those questions can go to our show page at WMIC.org and click on the lowdown. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking some of your calls. Our number here is 646-829-3985. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Howard Everson, City University Professor of Psychology and Senior Research Fellow at CUNY, and David Rinskopf, who is a Professor of Educational Psychology at CUNY. Again, the number 646-829-3985. We're talking about tests on today's Please Explain and taking your calls at 646-829-3985. My guests are David Rinskopf and, should I just say, professors David Rinskopf and Howard Everson. And let's go right to one of our callers, Kevin from Cobble Hill. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Leonard?
Okay.
I'm currently a social studies education major at NYU, and I'm wondering – nowhere in my program are we taught how to design tests, how to write tests, and all our assessments are authentic assessments, creating projects and all these other forms of assessments. So I'm wondering how new teachers are dealing with standardized testing and prepping students for standardized tests, but we're not specifically taught how to in the education programs.
Which one of you wants to tackle that?
I'll be happy to. Kevin raises a very, very good point. One of the struggles that we have with debunking myths about standardized tests and promoting good use of standardized tests is that our teaching faculty are not themselves taught how to create standardized tests, how to design them, how best to score them so that they produce the kinds of useful information that a classroom teacher needs about his or her students.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Mary from Kearny, New Jersey. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I wanted to ask, I'm a concerned parent as well as a teacher, and I have seen how the standardized testing has hurt education. I've seen for my child, for example, that her level of thinking on a higher order, thinking has decreased tremendously starting in the fourth grade when the teacher really started to feel the pressure from teaching to the test, and she was teaching to the test a lot. And I was just, you know, wondering what you had spoken about how President Obama is going to change the testing, and I'd love to hear more about that because it's been so harmful to teaching on that higher order, how teachers are constantly feeling pressured on teaching to the test.
That's true. And unfortunately, one of the consequences of testing is that people respond to the way they're being evaluated and do things differently. On the other hand, good teachers, if they teach the right way, will find out not only do they get their students to know more higher order things, but they also will do better on the standardized tests than if they just teach the rote ways that you're talking about. It's really a shame that the teachers don't recognize that there are better ways to do things.
Also, the new generation of tests that are currently on the planning boards will be designed in such a way to have a closer, much closer alignment between the curriculum, the instructional methods in the classroom, and then the assessment methods. In the past, there's been a serious disconnect between the external designs of tests and what teachers were actually doing in the classroom.
Let's go to David from the Bronx. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I just have a quick question about the impact of class on test performance. And my background is I went to one of the New York City specialized high schools, and the way it works is you need to take a quote-unquote entrance exam. I don't know if it's an achievement test or an IQ test, but I do know that middle-class parents and upper-middle-class parents send their kids to prep academies, sometimes for over 2 years, and those kids that come out of those academies make up the overwhelming majority of the people that get into these schools and go on to later opportunities and, you know, good colleges and grad schools. And I'm just wondering, if this is happening in a progressive area like in New York City, what is happening on a larger scale, maybe in areas that aren't even having this conversation? And just a second quick point, I recently got into the job market after a while of being in school, and I've taken the Wunderlich exam literally 4 times in the last month. And it's one thing that's not being discussed is the impact of these tests, not just on academic performance, but on the ability to get middle-class or white-collar jobs. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for calling us, and I'm going to add to that because another listener has written in on a similar subject on our comment page. Barbara from Westchester writes, what about the Volvo effect, that is, that SAT results correlate better with a student's family socioeconomic status rather than any kind of ability and performance?
Well, there is a growing amount of evidence to suggest that educational opportunity, socioeconomics, as we know from the economics literature, are highly related. Both of those are reflected in the distribution of test scores. So it's not at all uncommon to find that students with higher test scores come from more affluent communities, more affluent families, schools with greater resources. And I think we're seeing that in the distributions now that we are studying the distribution of student performance on a variety of tests. I mean, we see them in tests like the SAT as well as AP and even the state accountability tests. So this phenomena is real, and my sense is it's a reflection of the inequality of educational opportunity in the United States that we're struggling with.
Well, also, kids are brought up in households that have, in some cases, where they're more culturally enriched than in others, and should that be a factor in testing their knowledge? If a kid grows up with a lot of music and art and literature in the house, what does that prove other than the fact that kid had more advantages than the next kid?
It's true. It's true.
So how do you write tests that get past that?
Well, do you want to write tests that get past that? That's the question. Do you want to stare reality in the face or do you want to ignore it? If the reality is these kids know more, what do you want to do about it? You may want to make up for the kids who don't have that and then say that's something we want to do, and that's what compensatory education programs were about starting in the 60s, was to try to make up for some of that.
But isn't that why the old SATs look more like IQ tests?
Well, you could look at it in two ways. If you say look more like intelligence tests, then you don't want to imply that it means that it's something innate. An alternative way to look at it is it enables someone from a high school anywhere in the country who may not have had the best teaching but did a lot of reading on their own to show that they know how to do something, but it may not have been the curriculum of one of the bigger schools. So one of the ideas, not the only one, but one of the ideas of those kinds of tests being content, relatively content-free, that is not subject to the schooling effect, is that you therefore take away the advantage of someone who might have gone to a prep school.
Let's take some more. I know I went to a very poor high school, but we had SAT classes, SAT prep classes, for the kids who thought they may have an opportunity to do well on them. Mm-hmm. I didn't take them, by the way. Catherine from Massapequa, Long Island, you're on the air.
Hi. I was aware that the analogies came out of the SATs a number of years back, and my niece, who's much younger than I, she graduated Michigan just 2 years ago, posited a theory that she heard that this was part of an intentional dumbing down of the SATs to constrict the ability of students to understand things outside of the experience, their own experience, by comparing to things within their experience, which is what analogies help us learn. Can you explain why the analogies were taken out?
Yes. In the early 1990s, that was probably around 1992, 93, or somewhere in there, the chancellor of the University of California, Richard Atkinson, raised some concerns about the instructional validity of the SAT. That is, what the SAT was measuring versus what children, in particular in California, were being taught in their secondary schools. And he made a rather compelling argument at the time that the use of analogies and analogical reasoning was not a primary target of the secondary school curriculum. And through a series of discussions, broader discussions with the academic community and the higher education community, the College Board decided that it was time to revise the verbal section of the SAT. In fact, they called it the verbal reasoning section at the time, and redesign that section in such a way that it placed more emphasis on critical reading and critical thinking. And so that was really the underlying rationale for the redesign of that portion of the test.
Jack from Ridgewood, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I took the SATs in late 1953, and while the guidance chap at school told me I had done very well, in fact, he told me I scored over 700 on both the math and the verbal, he said he couldn't tell me my score due to an agreement with the ETS. Why was that?
That's an interesting point, Jack. Years ago, many years ago, the scores on the SAT were actually not considered your personal property, but the property of the contributing or participating institutions. So the scores were not revealed to you at the time, but they were sent on to the colleges and universities that you may have been applying to. That obviously has changed a great deal since then, because students now have access to their scores all the time and right away. As soon as they take the test, they can pretty much get their score reports from ETS. But that was a philosophical position that was taken back in the mid 20th century.
There are many tests that seem incredibly similar to the SAT, or at least in their formats. An alphabet soup of acronyms, the GMAT, the GRE, the MCAT, the LSAT. There's also the National Assessment of Educational Progress, known as NEP, is it?
NAEP.
Which is called the gold standard of tests. Mm-hmm. Are they all pretty much the same thing?
No, they're not. So, for example, the GMAT, the Graduate Management Admissions Tests, the MCAT is for the medical college, and the LSAT is for law school. So if you think about the kinds of things you might want a prospective lawyer to be able to do, it's a little different from the things you might want a prospective doctor to be able to do. And they're very different tests. So, for example, the MCAT obviously emphasizes the scientific background that you might need to go to medical school. So you have chemistry and biological sciences and physics and that sort of thing. And it's a knowledge test, whereas the LSAT is much more logical reasoning. You don't have to know a lot of facts to do well on the LSAT. You have to be able to reason well. So there are differences among these depending on what their purpose is.
You mentioned earlier that we probably would bring up comparisons with other parts of the world. Didn't the results of the PISA test recently indicate that Shanghai was the world leader in achievement? But then I heard, well, everything is taught by rote in Shanghai. So is that why those students are doing so well?
It's hard to know exactly, it's unfortunate because the PISA tests and tests like that, David alluded earlier that they're sort of norm reference tests, so they don't produce a lot of diagnostic information, and we can't get into the underlying details of why students or groups of students are performing, some groups are performing better than others. But we have our suspicions that there may be more drill and practice going on in some of these countries than in other countries. We do know that the countries vary not only in terms of their curriculum, but in their pedagogical techniques and approaches.
And the culture, how much these people have to study, and how rare it is for them to be able to go to a college, mm-hmm. and how competitive it is in some of these countries.
It was recently revealed, David, that New York State's test score gains were inflated, which followed similar revelations in states from Texas to Kentucky. What does it mean that test scores have been inflated?
Well, there's two different things that you have to distinguish. One of them is just not in New York State, I don't think, but in some other states, widely publicized cases of cheating, where teachers would go in and erase answers and put the right answers in. So that's one thing that you have to worry about. But the other is just what one of the callers alluded to earlier, which is teaching to the test. If you can predict what kind of questions they're going to be on those tests, and you just drill over and over, and you say, here's what they did last year, and we don't think they're going to change much this year, then that's doing better on the test, not by learning so much as you would like it to be.
We have very little time, but just one more question. Some people just do not do well on tests, but are really smart, do well in their lives after school. So in the end, why rely so much on tests?
Well, that's a great question, and I think you'd learn from David and I, if you spent some time with us, that one of our mantras would be don't rely so heavily on test scores. Use a variety of information, a variety of evidence to get a complete picture of the talents and abilities of a particular student or candidate. I think there's much too heavy a reliance on tests these days.
My guests on Please Explain today have been Howard Everson and David Rinskoff, both professors in the CUNY system. And I want to thank the two of you so much for talking to us today about tests.
Well, thank you very much.